You're listening to Perspectives in Parryville. Today, my guest is Daniel Burke, a creative media practitioner. In this episode, we find out about Daniel's background and current professional practice in creative media production, with a focus on animation and video. We explore how Daniel communicates to an audience with video. He guides us through some of the how-to technical skills he uses, as well as aspects that inform the craft of storytelling, especially with technology. Daniel outlines how he used video and other technology to create public health communication campaigns, mini documentaries, working with actual people from the community as they share their experiences. Daniel shares insights on how he uses a respectful, human-centered approach to negotiate and plan productions with actors and community members, and how he guides conversations during on-camera interviews. We chat about video production strategies, questioning techniques, building emotional rapport, and encouraging a comfortable conversation with on-camera speakers, as well as more complicated issues such as the ethics of documentary production. We explore how Daniel uses more technical, precise, and mathematical approaches in motion graphics and animation to still communicate human-centered stories and ideas which evoke emotions from an audience. As you might have guessed, we talk about AI, artificial intelligence, and the role this technology might play in creative media production. Daniel emphasizes how fundamentally humans connect with stories and how we might use video as a social communication tool in our technologically fluid world. Here's my conversation with Daniel Burke. So, very nice to see you again, Daniel. It's been a while.
Yeah, thanks for having me today. I'm excited.
So, I'm interested to know what led to us having this conversation. You know, we can go as far back in time as you want to, but I want to hear a little bit more about who you are, what you're interested in, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll go back to as far as, you know, what led me into wanting to get to where I am right now. So I actually didn't finish my high school certificate. Right? Wild. So I finished year 11 and sort of decided at that point in time, I don't want to keep doing this. And so I just finished up. And I sort of went through a few, you know, just retail type jobs, and just felt like I was floating around in the world. But had this sort of burning creativity desire inside of me. And
as happens.
Yeah, didn't really have a...
How did you know that? Like, what form did it take?
Well, it didn't take a form, which is problematic, you know?
But you knew it was it.
The tortured artist, if you will. And so I remember going to a Comic Con type... what's the right
convention?
Word? Convention, that's the word. Yeah. Thank you. And
that's the con of... Comic Con.
Right, yes. And so we sort of came across a stall that was saying, hey, come do this animation course. And I was like, oh, I really like animation. I like drawing a lot. This could be really fun. And so signed up on the spot and just made the decision of, you know what, I'm going to change things around. Let's do this. Why not?
Oh, so at the convention, there was like a kind of vendor's stall or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly, yeah, for a particular college. And so I just went, this sounds amazing. They gave me the sales pitch and it worked. And so I sort of went and did a little bit of study there and realized I actually didn't quite like animation at all. You know, I had a very different preconceived notion of what I would be doing and realized, hey, I'm not particularly enjoying this study.
I'm assuming it was like electronic animation, or
traditional? No, it was sort of very 3D based, but I also was in a sort of creative industries degree, so there was a lot of doing some of this, some of that, a little bit of something else.
So how far through did you get?
So I think I did maybe 6 months in total there. And, you know, I was sort of in a class that was about making board games, and I was just, what am I doing here? This is
you're bored by the board games.
Yeah, the clue is in the name. And just sort of went, you know what? I'm not interested in this per se, but had really found through that I enjoyed one of the film units that was part of the creative industries output. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to change over and just prioritize the sort of filmmaking. And had really not had much desire outside of that first sort of little taste for filmmaking, and realized that that was a big passion of mine, and all the puzzle pieces sort of fit together.
Had you, like, you knew it was a passion of yours from previously, like you had an interest in film, I'm assuming.
Yeah. And so, you know, I absolutely loved, you know, watching films and enjoying them, and sort of a little bit of digital creative output, but nothing that went, I'm going to make films for a living. So it wasn't until sort of going through that initial unit, and the lecturer that was there was just a really inspiring person and really sort of ignited that passion in a really lovely way. And just sort of, you know, did a bit more investigating and realized that I could do a much more specialized degree, and sort of swapped over and went to a different college. And
what a creative description.
Yes. to put it lightly.
Well, it's good though that you had that realization, and you kind of, for lack of a better word, pulled the plug. You kind of,
yeah,
you adapted your approach, and, you know, to kind of got a V2 time happening.
Yeah. And so I went over and started studying somewhere else, and realized that, you know, a dear friend of mine of now, who we became really close towards the end of the degree, didn't realize they also had done the exact same thing and left that college and went to the new one in the exact same pattern. And so we connected really well. But throughout doing that degree in film, just realized I had a really big passion for sharing stories in that particular medium, and graduated as valedictorian, which was fantastic. And
I do remember that.
Yes, you were there. So
you did a good job, as I remember.
Yeah, it was one of those, you know, just managed to find a niche that I really, really loved and wanted to throw everything at it possible. And I wasn't doing it in a, I must get the best grades possible. It was a, I want to do as well as I can because I want my craft to be good. And I wasn't necessarily chasing marks or grades, and it just, you know, happened to be that they were good grades.
Yeah, in creative industries, yeah, it's kind of the expression is the, exactly, should be the driver rather, exactly, than the grade.
Yeah.
So what, from, as I think back, what sort of creative work were you producing?
So whilst at, you know, while studying the bachelor, it was very much guided by what the units were, and doing a little bit of, you know, things here and there to just build up more sort of a body of work, but nothing that was special or intrinsic to me. It was more just let's learn the craft at that point in time.
So what did you learn?
The craft.
What does that mean? For those people that may be teachers, sure, possibly, or other students in the audience,
yeah,
what did you learn? What does one learn at a film school?
So obviously it's a lot of the technical skills, the how to, you know, here is a camera, here's how you do XYZ, here's the info you need to know to expose a shot correctly, all those kind of technical things, which realistically anyone could learn if they sort of studied that particular technology.
Just watch a YouTube clip.
Yes, the difference though is that you learn how to tell a story, right? You learn what it is that makes film or a video special. What is those?
What is it? What's the answer to that question?
Well, that's the million-dollar question,
we're
isn't it?
We're preempting part three, yeah, of this podcast, yeah, episode, but
it's a tricky one because you need to have an understanding of your own voice. You need to have an understanding of what you want to say, and you need to know how to say that. So, you know, there is a very unique and personal approach to being able to create video, and putting all of that in the hands of a client who wants you to do that for their voice can be, you know, a skill you need to learn as well, which is something that I think, you know, I've got a pretty good hold on. But yeah, so I learned that the how to tell the story and how to tell a good story and how to pretty much how to communicate to an audience through the medium of video. You know, you can put any sort of images together and try and say something, but without a really good understanding of, you know, image A next to image B equals meaning C.
I reckon that's the Kuleshov effect.
Absolutely the Kuleshov effect, right? You know, so it's those sort of values that you learn, and that mentorship of having someone who can be there and guide you through it and sort of say, hey, I really like your idea, what you're working with, this is great. What if, have you thought about, why did you?
Oh, those yeah, possibilities, sort
of,
yeah.
Exactly. And that's for me the difference of, you know, the learning on YouTube or the independent learning is you don't have that guiding voice of expertise to sort of say, hey, what if, you know?
And so it's a social aspect of learning and teaching, I guess, is valuable.
Yes, and especially in the sort of film and video world, a lot of people do say, well, I could just do this online. Like, well, you can, but you're not going to, you know, you maybe don't have access to the types of technology that you need to learn and the voices and the industry connections and whatnot. So, you know.
You'd finished your study by the time the pandemic arrived, hadn't you?
Yeah, a few years prior. So yeah. I had started my master's in the middle of the pandemic. So after graduating the bachelor, I went and worked at a community organization and was doing a lot of sort of sexual health campaigns.
What does that mean?
So it's a lot of advocacy work via video to promote good sexual health and sexual health information to minority groups who may not be aware of the type of things that were being discussed. So sort of public health campaign work to educate and inform, yeah.
So what sort of creative approaches did you use?
Well, I was able to just sort of, you know, my identity as a queer person and my professional skill set that I just, you know, started to polish and figure out, I was suddenly able to have two worlds collide and go, hold on, I can be queer and make things for queer people. This is fantastic. And so sort of having that understanding of being the minority group that was the target and being the person, you know, behind the curtain, if you will, just led to being able to make some really interesting work. And communicate to people in a way that I would want to be communicated to.
So were they like, what sort, like were they stories with actors or stories with real people or?
Both.
Okay, both.
Our preference was always at this particular organization to use, you know, talent and people from the community. So a lot of the work we did was more documentary style, if you will, where it was interviewing people about their experiences, and finding that community voice that could help tell the narrative of the public health information we wanted to share.
So you're making like little documentaries by the sounds of it. I have seen them. I mean, not by the sounds of it. Little mini documentaries, but they've got a purpose.
Absolutely.
Underlying purpose.
Yeah. So, you know, there would be a bit of their individual story, a little bit of a guided, you know, could you talk about this and say it maybe in these words
for
the particular, you know, health information that we wanted to make sure was part of the campaign. But overall, it needed to be from community to community by community. So that approach just worked really well, and that really made me understand that the artistic value of, you know, sort of how to put it into the words. You can't tell a story about someone else unless you have walked in their shoes a little bit. You know, this value is really important to me in the sense that I don't want to tell stories about people that I can't understand or relate to or have that experience. And for me, it's, you know, there's a consultation involved if I do want to try and tell that story, or an encouragement of collaborating in a way where I can really understand the perspective of what it is I'm trying to make. And whether that be for a client or for my own work or, you know, anything else, it's just important to me that, you know, if it's about a community or a person, that they're involved in the process as much as possible to just get the correct and right perspective shared. So yeah, after sort of doing a bunch of this community work for a few years, I eventually created my own production company which I was working with some clients doing some freelance things, and you know, had just sort of reached a point in that particular community work where I wasn't necessarily feeling challenged and wanted to sort of branch out a little bit. And I ended up heading back to my college in a facilitator lecturing position, sort of part-time, and you know, doing all these different things and just becoming a real busy bee, and eventually decided to jump on over and lecture in film studies full-time.
What's teaching like for you?
It's fantastic.
What do you like about teaching?
For me, it's building those relationships with the future generation of creators, and you know, inspiring. And there was yourself included in this. The lecturers that I had were people that really inspired and motivated me to want to learn and grow and become a better person and put my artistic vision to the world. And so being in a position to give that back to the next generation of filmmakers is something that's really important to me. And I just genuinely enjoy seeing those sort of light bulb moments where it all suddenly clicks and makes sense. And you know, that feeling, I remember experiencing it myself, and being able to give that feeling to someone else is really valuable and precious.
You're listening to Perspectives in Parryville.
So when you're in the world making, you know, producing media, mm-hmm. you kind of mentioned a few minutes back about sometimes you work with actors, sometimes you work with real people.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what is that like?
Yeah, there is a very particular challenge when working with a community or just people who haven't been in front of a camera before. In that when you're working with actors, it's their profession. They're very comfortable being on that side. They understand what's happening. They know the process. But when you put someone who is either from community or just really inexperienced, but you need that perspective from them, it can be a challenge to overcome. And there is a very different strategy of directing someone who is an actor and is, you know, used to being in that position versus someone who's never done it and very maybe uncomfortable with the entire process. And I've sort of
I'm secretly internally laughing like at this moment, because I too have experienced this phenomenon.
Yep.
But I'm very interested to hear what you're going to tell me.
I'll give you all the insider tips and tricks that I do. It is one of those things of just understanding firstly, what it might feel like to be in their shoes, right? They've been encouraged to come forward and have this
tapped
conversation.
On the shoulder. Yep,
and
you're it.
Especially in public health, in those types of situations, we were often talking about sexual health, which was a very private thing for some people. And encouraging someone to talk about
that. I'd say for most people, it is a private matter, generally.
And so encouraging someone to talk about their sex life on camera that could potentially be seen by lots and lots of people to inform other people about good sexual health is a very specific challenge.
It's highly charged. So
yeah.
What did you do? Like when you met these people, hello? And they sit down in the hot seat, and then you can see that they're fidgeting, possibly, or yeah, I don't know. What?
So one of the first things to do is just really reassure them that the reason they are there is for a good purpose, you know, and explaining the sort of bigger context and value of what they're contributing to. Whether it be a public health campaign, whether it just be a short documentary, whether it be a discussion about someone's life, right? It's just explaining the value of what they're about to go through.
And does that work, I guess, in the first instance? Or do you have to have a couple of goes at it? Or
I've normally found that it seems to resonate well with them, because that's the reason they've agreed to be there, right? They can see a bigger picture, and there is a reason for me sharing this information. You know, it's not always it's very rarely, I'm going to get my limelight moment. And, you know, in these particular cases, that wasn't what people were wanting to do. And so they were able to immediately go, you know what, that's correct. The reason I'm here is to help in this particular particular environment.
The purpose, the context, the kind of their intrinsic motivation possibly. Exactly. Or even like if they've got some other factor going on. But I guess it's kind of having that moment.
Yes.
Talking it through.
Yeah. And we also found that being as less invasive as possible. So
how do you achieve that?
I think with just pure transparency. Yeah, you know, we're going to ask you about this.
I think I made it funny then.
You did. What does transparency look like? Well, if you're a designer, it's white and grey squares.
We can relate to that. Yeah. So, well, as a filmmaker, what does transparency look like?
Well, it's a very interesting ethical dilemma that can either divide you as a documentarian or a humanitarian.
I'm all ears.
Yeah. I just think in documentary in particular, there can sometimes be a lot of ethics considered where you are potentially interviewing, you know, the critical villain of the documentary, if you will. And so you potentially hoodwink them into having an interview, and then you drill them with questions they didn't expect, and you get a response that makes it into the documentary, and they suddenly look like an awful person.
There's certainly one approach to documentary
exactly making. And this is not it. You need to essentially do the exact opposite of that. And that's not to say that all documentaries are made with that sort of process, but some are. And you know, they're,
well, we got to weave a narrative somehow, you know, is what someone might say.
And so in that sense, you would consider that approach to be documentarian. You know, you are sort of documenting but also guiding it, whereas the sort of humanitarian approach is more human-centric and, you know, this is what we are after, this is what we would like, here is the information. There's no sort of curtain or frosty glass that's, you know, we're going to do this, but then actually there's a bigger agenda involved. It's never like that.
So what did you actually literally say to these participants in the sort of project that you're mentioning?
So there would be a bit of discussion prior to actually rocking up and going, hey, jump in front of the camera, and making it really clear what the objective of the video or the campaign or, you know, we would often seek participants to come forward themselves. So there would be a level of, engagement where they're interested in having their voice heard rather than us approaching someone random and going, hey, talk about this thing. So that sort of solved the first barrier of, you know, let's find people who are interested in actually talking, and that softens the entire conversation from then on out. And the next thing was, as I mentioned, reassuring them, on the day of production, if there's any sort of jitters, but even just in general, just really reassuring them, this is the benefit.
And do you give them the questions beforehand?
Sometimes, case by case sort of thing.
So if they're on board and they're comfortable, do you still get, and I think I know the answer, you still get people that are nervous because there's a camera. So how do you deal with that?
You make the first five questions not what you need it to be. So, for example, in a sexual health campaign, you wouldn't go straight in with the, you know, well, tell me about your sex life, because that's a very confronting question to ask up front. And if they're nervous, you're not going to get as rich of a story as you can or would like to, or even that they're maybe comfortable with.
So what do you ask them?
Just general anything. You know, how's your day? Have you been on camera before? Or while recording and making it obvious that we have started the interview. The interview process is underway. And
what's the point of all that?
Well, it just eases people. And the goal is for them to feel as though it's conversation and to just forget that all the cameras and the lights are shining on them, and that it is, you know, that rapport building. If you can have great rapport with someone, you're able to coach through those types of conversations. And often a challenge that comes up for people is when the participants that are speaking on camera don't necessarily get the answer that you wanted or quite deliver it in a way that you're happy with, or they fall short a little bit. A novice interviewee, if you will, interviewer, could really easily just move on and, you know, go, we'll deal with that in post and hopefully we can come up with something that fixes it. And I understand that. I've done that. You know, it's something that everyone goes through.
Yeah. So until, then when you get to post and you realise, I should have
asked some more questions about this thing. We don't have enough.
So what would you recommend that you do? What's the best practice, Saul?
It's a very simple question. Could you tell me a little bit more about that? And it offers the power of choice. You know, yeah, I could tell you some more about that, blah, 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 blah. But it also opens the floodgates. You know, in general conversation in the world, us humans tend to sometimes pull a little bit back in the hopes of, you know, invitation to overshare. And
could you tell me a little bit more about that?
I would love to. And it's very much that, you know, sometimes we'll really put things up in a nice, neat little bow to deliver the message quite succinctly and hope that it landed. But secretly, we have often a desire to go, well, there's a lot more context here. I want to tell you everything. And so asking someone, could you tell me a little bit more about that, really offers them the power, but then they go, oh, they want to know everything. And the floodgate will open and off they go.
So you've observed and experienced this by the sounds of it several times.
That's my secret thing. Is if I, rather than sort of going, we actually really need you to speak more about this one particular thing because we really need this video to do...
Dreadful tone.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And, you know, immediately the participant goes, oh, I've not done it right. They're not going to use this footage. This is really bad. I'm messing this up. It completely avoids all of that. And by just asking, could you tell me more about it? They could answer in whatever way they want, but you're going to get more information about that particular thing. And so it's less guiding them through the specific things you want to happen and finding when they do talk about that thing you need, asking them to elaborate on that a little bit if you need more.
So are you there, like, is there a producer looking over your shoulder or you're the sole trader?
Yeah, sometimes it's just myself because small budget type things. Sometimes there are a few other people in the room, but generally I like to sit in that sort of interviewee seat. And
interviewer.
I keep getting those two mixed up. It's because I'm the interviewee at the moment. it's confusing. I like to sit in that interviewer seat and sort of guide the conversation. And that's a particular skill that, you know, I've been able to finesse over the last sort of 5-6 years of doing this type of work. And it's transferred over into the way that I would direct an actor as well is very different now compared to sort of what I might have done in the past.
Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, of
course. What did you used to do and how do you do it? How do you approach directing an actor?
So I think when I think about directing actors, it's something I don't do very often because I prefer this sort of documentary type style of work. And so when I do work with actors, it historically was during study when I was still trying to figure it all out. And it would be almost instructional and really, you know, not nice, you know, do that but happier. Really dreadful, right? And it's such a common experience that even, you know, my students to this day are sort of, it's a particular skill set to learn because yes, our actors are, you know, essentially working for us and we need to direct them, but they're still human beings, right?
So what's the better approach?
Just a combination of both of that. So I often find explaining the emotional hook of what that character is going through in that moment and explaining...
For example?
Oh gosh, an example.
We need a tangible example.
We need a tangible example. So for example, if I was directing this conversation and trying to give me an actor guidance here, I would say, you know, you're a bit lost for words and you're confused and you really want this to go well, but you're struggling to find the right example. What do you think that might look like? Could you try that in the next take? And that approach is much nicer because it's explaining the emotion rather than going into specifics of, you know, put your left hand here, scratch your head there. And every director has a different sort of approach to what they would like. But for me, the type of acting that I need from talent isn't about that sort of continuity, scripted type thing. It's normally more public health service. So, you know, those are two very different approaches, and my approach for directing actors probably wouldn't work in directing scripted films, because you need the blocking of particular hand movement and body movement, etc. Whereas a lot of my work is, you know, down the barrel of the camera, and it's delivering lines in a particular way. So, you know, that approach works really well for the work that I do, but again, not a one size fits all in terms of directing actors.
So you prefer like real life, like speaking to real people, like a documentary style of approach. What other things, apart from your public health kind of territory, what sort of other messages have you helped people to facilitate?
Absolutely. Through public health campaigns, there's not always budget, right? So we had to get creative in how we would tell messages. And so I picked up a particular skill set of sort of using motion graphics to, you know, be the conduit that meant we didn't need to go to a set, pay all this money, do all of that type of stuff. So learning how to animate things, and found through that, I actually really digged animation, which was such a, hold on, this is where I first started and really didn't enjoy animation.
What?
But suddenly, 3-4 years later, I'm here.
What happened?
I think it was one of those unfortunate circumstances where I wasn't inspired when I was learning.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy.
Yeah, big call. That's probably why I didn't mention their name. And
what is that? What's going on there?
It's a much bigger question, isn't it? But I just wasn't enjoying it, and I didn't feel inspired when I first learnt it.
So that was then, but then with this new kind of revisiting of animation,
what were the sparkly bits
for you?
Well, it was purpose-driven, right? So we needed to, we only have this amount of money, we only have this amount of time, what is possible?
And I was Do you like that kind of the parameters of a...
Yeah, I love a creative challenge in that sense of, you know, here's a brief, be creative. Right. Obviously, there's a lot of constraints and guidelines and time and money and all those types of things involved. But sometimes that challenge is fun. You know, all right, cool. Well, we can do this. So I, in one of those creative crunch moments, just decided, you know what, I'm going to try and animate something real quick. And it turned out pretty good. And, you know, my bosses at the time were like, can you do that again? So, yeah, okay, well, let's keep making some more. And just over time, I learnt this skill set that I was avoidant about at the start of my studying, and realized I really like doing this. This is actually a lot of fun. I'm skilled in this and I understand what's going on. The one thing that a lot of people don't realize about animation is that it is very mathematical. You need to be able to work with numbers to get good animation. And
how does that work?
And not in a sense that, you know, you're doing complex algebra or anything like that, but, you know, understanding how the numbers in animation work is more about understanding the sort of resolutions of the image you're working with, so what the pixels are, you know, and then understanding individual elements. So, for example, everything has an anchor point, and that anchor point has 2 pixels associated with it, one on an x-axis and one on a y. And if you're working in 3D, you've then got a z-axis. And understanding how those numbers relate to each other, and, you know, I want this object to move from the left to the right of my screen, I need to know what those numbers are and where they relate to in the bigger image. So knowing how those numbers interact with each other is one thing. You can move something from A to B over a second of time and it moves continuously between those 2 points. But if you want to add some flourish or some flair, having it maybe speed up towards the end of that movement to look like it's falling, you need to understand sort of what's called a speed graph and how you can manipulate those to encourage an idea of a moving object or evoke an emotion that, you know, very specific sort of calculations, if you will, allow the audience to do and see. And so for me, I was always really good at math in sort of high school and whatnot, and I've just realized, hold on, I don't necessarily need to do this in a highly prescriptive or thinking about it way. I can animate with numbers. And so I was able to blend these two sort of ideas together that always had felt really foreign and uncomfortable. And all of a sudden I realized this whole animation makes sense if I can play with numbers. And I found a real nice beauty in the mathematical side of animation that I never expected to enjoy. And, you know, so sometimes I do, you know, go a little bit too heavy on playing around with the numbers just because I can. And for me, I'm the only person inside the software who's ever going to know that that was a nice whole number and not a decimal point. But for me, that's just something I like to do. And I find that mathematical challenge fun. And so understanding the, you know, that side of the equation was great. I just really found that this worked in my mind in a way that I hadn't expected it to. And that creative challenge of understanding it from a different perspective opened a whole new world of, you know, an area that I could learn and grow on my own. And through that, I was able to expand my creative output to the world, and it wasn't suddenly video. I could also do animation and motion graphics, and I went on to further study in visual graphics visual communication, so that I could, communicate visually with digital design as well as video making. One of the interesting things is that these two types of work that I do most are so polarizing in that they are on very different ends of the spectrum. So we have this very specific human-focused type of conversation that we're hoping to use in a way that informs and engages with audiences to, you know, give public health information, for example. And then on the other end, we've got creativity by numbers, where it's animated and it's motion graphics and it needs to be precise, and there is, you know, a lot of technical skills that are less human focused involved. And a lot of people I find often like to sit in the middle of that and do, you know, the other sort of creative work, where I really like to, you know, when I get briefs that allow me to do one of those things, that's what gets me excited and goes, this is going to be fun, versus, you know, something of less interest and more just, yeah, I can do that for you, let's make it happen. It doesn't get that creative passion going. Whereas a really sort of complex animation or a complex sort of case to unpack and have someone talk about their experience with a particular, you know, bloodborne illness, for example, is really interesting for me. And that's an area that I like to sort of situate myself in and just be a bit different from what other people are potentially doing.
You're listening to Perspectives in Parryville.
So you sound like you're on fire. You've got a lot of things going on.
Yeah, so I finished my master's. I'm teaching full time. I've got my production company going now. So I changed some internal structures from a sole trader over to a production company for really boring reasons. But through doing that, I wanted to really brand myself in more of that company type language and to just attract, you know, more people in. And so far that approach has worked quite well. I've been able to grow and have new clients. And part of the interesting thing for me was starting to experiment with AI in how I approached my website, because I was...
How is it that we could have a conversation without mentioning AI?
I mean, it's everywhere at the moment. It's a fascinating world. I personally am really curious and just interested by what AI can offer the world.
So you were telling us about your website and AI.
Yeah. So I'm not a copywriter, right? It's
as in like writing words for kind of websites or magazines.
I imagine words in copywriting as print words. You know, I'm used to working in the spoken language world of things. And so when I need to write something quite concise, I often, you know, in my work rely on other people to tell that story for me. And it's me weaving that story through their spoken words. So when I need to speak or communicate in this type of context, I don't enjoy it, because I rely heavily on other people's sort of language and words and help using them to tell the story, as we've discussed in sort of that public health campaign type work, for example. So when it came time to sort of rebranding my website, I found it quite challenging to find the voice of my website and of DB Media.
And of you? That's you.
That's me, yeah. So, you know, it's a company, but it's pretty much me and, you know, subcontracting here and there and whatnot. So I sort of wrote up a few things to start with and just really didn't enjoy...
The writing process?
Not necessarily the writing process, but I knew the type of tone that I wanted.
Which was what?
So I wanted to be casual yet serious, open and invitational, but also just sort of a bit of a breath of fresh air and really informative yet polite. So all of these polar opposites.
So what did you go? How did you approach that?
So I sort of wrote it all out myself first, right? And I really spent some time thinking about the language and what I want to say, not necessarily how I want to say it. So I just figured out, what is it that I want to say? What is it I want my website to do? And then I sort of started to play with the language a little bit. And then I did some just sort of independent research on, you know, using AI, and sort of jumped into the wonderful world of ChatGPT and started coming up with some complex prompts and asking ChatGPT, rather than just saying, hey, write the copy for my website, go.
Well, what a prompt.
Yeah, right. I needed to say, here's what I've written. Here is my goal. Can you align these two?
I like that a lot.
For lack of explaining the prompts themselves. But before I even got to that point, I asked ChatGPT to find me the resources to actually, you know, get my copy to start with. So I said, you know, the classic academic in me sort of went, all right, ChatGPT, my goal is to write, you know, some copy for my website. I want it grounded in literature. Where should I start reading? And it spat out a bunch of references. And so I went and looked them up, read through them, and sort of got ChatGPT to start my literature review, if you will. And so...
So for people that are not academically minded or involved in research, what is a literature review?
So it's essentially looking at peer-reviewed knowledge of academics and researchers who've put their work into the world and their research. And a literature review is finding what is some of the prominent conversation and research and outputs in a particular field.
So in your field, it's media production.
Absolutely. So for me, it would be media production. But for this specific one, I needed more information on website building, because that's not a skill set I have. And this was me wanting to do it myself purely to save money, because I didn't want to spend the $25,000 I kept getting quoted. And so I went, I can do this on my own. I'm not on a time crunch. I can spend the time upskilling. And I used ChatGPT in a way to guide me of where to start looking in that literature. And once I sort of got those, you know, building blocks, I was able to then sort of launch off into some of the more interesting and specific work that those particular readings guided me towards and where I found interested. Normally with a formal sort of literature review, it's a whole other process. But for me, this was poking around and finding information and just seeing what has worked and what has been proven to work.
Well, where are you leading? Where are you heading with all this? What's the rationale for even talking about AI and your website, you know?
Well, I found that AI works really well as a tool. And I asked it, write the copy for my website, and said, I'm a video production company. That's all I said. And it spat out a whole bunch of nonsense that I was like, I can't use this, this is awful. And to be expected, right? So I needed to figure out my tone, my brand, my voice, and I needed to write it myself first so that ChatGPT had something to work with.
So is that what you did? You wrote your first draft?
More like a third or fourth draft by that point. But I put it in there and went, spit this back out with this tone and voice in mind. And what it gave me was okay. But I liked it a lot more than what I had in that draft currently. And so I then used it as the next draft and continued to edit over the top of that. And so it gave me, not the final result, but it gave me a much more solid fifth draft, if you will, to then get to the final. So it was sort of a nice refinement, but it definitely was not the final result. And I think that a lot of people are worried that AI will take over the world and, you know, there'll be no jobs left for people. And in some very particular circumstances, I definitely think that could be a possibility. But in the greater context of the world, I think we really need to look at AI as a tool. And it doesn't have a creative voice, right? It can only do what we ask it to do. And the more that we refine how we prompt things and how we ask, you know, machine learning to learn, it can only go off what it can go off, right? It can't introduce new ideas or come up with that creative thing that humans have.
I've got a question.
Yeah.
What came to mind as you're talking is I couldn't help but compare there was a combination of instructions and computers and emotions for both the animation that you mentioned before and now this other technology. Yep. So, I mean, what's going on? You seem really comfortable with using like a ringmaster type thing or, you know, circus, no, not performer. Yep. You're calling the shots. You're providing instructions.
Exactly.
To computers and other technology, but it seems very human in the process. So can you tell us, well, what's going on there?
Well, I think ultimately, you know, it comes down to the creator. If you have a creative vision or a creative concept that you want to achieve, you'll use whatever tool you can to make that come to life. And there's always been polarizing moments in the history of just humans in general, even maybe over the last 100 years as technology's evolved, that this is just the current one that as artists we're going, this is going to change things, but not really, I don't think it will. I think if we can use the technology as a tool to help our creative vision and creative ideas come to life, then why shouldn't we?
So you've already done like using it with, say, crafting paragraphs for a website. Mm-hmm. Have you used it in, say, other areas like script development or?
I haven't used it in script development, but I have used it in a way to generate imagery. Spicy.
Tell us about that.
It's never been used in a final output, but I've used it in a way to help create that sort of initial mood board for an idea.
Yeah, mood board, storyboard type
so
of
that
territory.
Preliminary planning and trying to experiment and get ideas and, you know, have sort of just in a way shoehorned two ideas together and asked for an image and then looked at it and gone, I don't know if that's quite right or what I'm actually thinking of, but able to go, cool, put that in the folder, that's a good mood board type thing. So it's a good way to get visual ideas and get interesting sort of content created, but I don't necessarily think it's a good way to have final output on things.
Yeah, do you think there will ever be, do you think people will start to use it for final output? Or, you know, it's still sort of too early to say, or
with the result of the strike at the moment, you know, being quite prominent in that AI was in that discussion of not having actors image replicated with artificial intelligence for film, with that sort of being highly discussed and highly publicized, I think humans are starting to see how that might be a bad thing. And what that bigger conversation is of AI-generated art not necessarily being, you know, artistically, ethically correct. And so whilst I think it can be used in as a tool, I don't think it should or could end up being, you know, I don't think we're going to sit down and meaningfully watch the next Marvel film that was purely AI. You know, there are people's jobs who are going to be doing that forever, right? We've just, filmmaking is at a peak at the moment where video content is so important on social media, but we have endless streaming services now that need to be filled with wonderful catalogs of interesting content to convince audiences to pay money to subscribe to those libraries. So we've got you know, a wonderful world of video and film just being the thing that people are enjoying and eating up and consuming in terms of their entertainment. And I just don't know that AI is going to get to the level of replacing 2,500 people's jobs to bring that to life.
Why not?
I don't think people want it to. Yeah, I think it's an interesting area of playfulness and creative intrigue, but I just don't think we're going to get to the point where a director's going to sit down and go, I'm going to make my whole movie using this app.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of the kind of technology, in a way, it can be used, but if it's too prominent or if it's too central or if it loses the heart or the human aspect, then it's like it's counterproductive. What's the point? No one's going to enjoy watching it, or, you know, the percentage of audiences might be so small. It's kind of like, I don't know, I'm just kind of rambling myself.
Well, I mean, to put it in a very, very loose, you know, analogy of things we've been talking about so far today, is that for these sort of public health campaigns, we use community because an actor just doesn't feel quite as believable. And, you know, not that it doesn't feel as believable, it just ethically doesn't feel right. You know, so we sort of go, all right, well, let's get someone who understands this and someone who wants to talk about this and has experience in it to actually go in front of camera rather than someone who we provide lines to and go, here's what we want you to say, here's what we want you to do. In this very particular circumstance of public health, you know, that's not the right way to do that. And so I feel it's very similar with AI. You know, we have you could do that where you sat in and went, hey, just make this film. Here's your script. Give me all the visuals. Off you go. But it's not going to feel the same as having a wonderfully creative team with different ideas and different perspectives and different experiences come to the table and bring their individual ideas forward.
So you're painting a picture that's very much a human picture with people interacting, collaborating, the whole creative process itself. I'm not sure where I'm leading with all this. I'm just kind of, I guess this is the nature of a dialogue.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's interesting times. And I think a lot of people are maybe scared by AI. And I understand that hesitation.
Like on a job level?
Or? Yeah. Or even just, you know, that sort of very George Orwellian, Big Brother is watching and coming for us type, you know, existential crisis, if you will, a little bit of AI is going to take over and dominate and it's going to be the big thing. It's current. It's a bubble. We're interested, we're inspired, we're excited, we're maybe scared. And that makes sense. But I think in maybe 10 or 15 years, AI isn't going to be as maybe daunting as a concept as it is right now. People will either jump in and use it and find really cool ways to use it as a tool, but I don't necessarily think it's going to overtake the world. Well, I think, you know, video is changing the world, and it's the medium that people are currently enjoying the most, right? So, and that can be in any context, you know.
What are some of those contexts?
Well, I mean, the moving image, to put it really simply, but that could be, you know, watching things on TikTok that creators have made, watching things on Instagram, you know, people curating their stories, to be very specific. That Kuleshov effect we talked about, A plus B equals C, I'm a very happy person on Instagram. But also, you know, broadcast, you've got streaming, you've got movies, you've got reels, you've got paid advertisement. There's so much video out in the world, but it used to be in sort of the, you know, 80s and 90s that it was very print-based and a lot of information was communicated in that sort of two-dimensional printed, you have this one poster of information, whereas currently it's a bit more fluid. There's, you can have moving images, you can say a lot more. You can, you know, in algorithm world, you have 3 seconds to grab people's attention, and if you don't, they've moved on. And so the way that we communicate with video in this sort of social context has completely changed as well, as people try to stay in people's algorithms and engaged in that first 3 seconds and hooking people in. So as a society, we've learnt to grab people's attention with video really quickly because we need to, because it's such a big competitive world. And I think that that has bled over a little bit into the way that films are being made and the way that we engage with, you know, maybe reality TV and streaming services and those different types of content. And at the end of the day, I think we need to make content that relates to humans. I think we need to keep society and humans in mind when we're making content. You know, we're making it for people and not necessarily chasing numbers or chasing particular outputs or strategies or those types of things. Yes, they're important to make sure the right people are getting the information, but I just think there's a critical element of making sure that we're not focused too heavy on, all right, well, I need the first 3 seconds to be brilliant so people stay and watch. The whole thing should be brilliant so that people stay and watch. And if you can find a way to do that, then you're good. I think for me, the thing that really inspires and just gets me excited about the landscape of media production at the moment is that ability to share stories. And at the end of the day, that's what humans connect with. We connect with storytelling. We connect when someone is sharing a piece of them with you. And I think that's very similar to art, and therefore I think translates over into the world of video and media production as well. It's a little chunk of, you know, either one person or many people that they're happily sharing with the world. And that sort of human shareability of storytelling in media production is probably why media at the moment is so popular, is you have that ability to share your story and connect and have those human emotions come through, and an audience will relate with that. You know, they will enjoy that type of thing. And, you know, so that sharing of human stories, I think, is, you know, where AI is going to struggle. For me, when I want to use community to tell my story, it's because I don't have that lived experience. I can't write that story. I can't write that perspective. I need someone else to tell that story and guide that for me, so that there is a narrative that is authentic and represents people and individuals and communities and minorities and larger people and groups correctly. And that authenticity and that voice, I think, is really, really important when thinking about even making video or media or anything, is thinking about the audience, who it's representing, why it's representing them, what it says about them, what it says about the larger group, what it says just in general, what is the information you're putting into the world through this product or through this video, and being able to understand and know that context, I think, is a very human-centric approach. And thinking about your audience, thinking about how you communicate to them, the ways in which the audience, the target audience, might respond or react or, you know, interpret, not interpret, is something that we as humans have the ability to do with media making. And that's taken us 130 years to figure out, to get to this point right where we are now, especially in video. That to consider, you know, to wrap that thought up, I don't think AI can do that. I don't think it has the very specific nuance and authentic lived experience and storytelling to share those thoughts with the world and make an audience understand and relate to that. And that's where we as media producers fit. That's where our landscape is to, you know, create that content and understand the nuance and understand the perspective, all of those things I've just mentioned. You can't make a prompt for that. To put it super, super simply and concise, if I could sort of, you know, have the audience take one thing away who listen to this podcast, it would be that tell the story however you need to, right? Use whatever tools you have available. If you are able to use video, use it. If you're able to use animation, use it. If you want to use AI, use it. If you're able to use print, use it, right? But it has to be for the right purpose. And you need to know who it is you're talking to, how they like to be spoken to, understanding your target audience, where that target audience lives, you know, is going to guide you on what tools to use and what is and isn't appropriate and how you communicate that message to someone.
In this episode, I chatted with Daniel Burke. You can find more information about this episode in the show notes, including links to Daniel's website, DB Media. Thank you for listening to Perspectives in Parryville.